The headlines, the city of Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine is a scene of fierce clashes between Russian troops and Ukrainian forces on the seventh day of the conflict. President Biden bans Russian flights from U.S. skies following similar moves by the European Union and Canada. And also ahead, Brent crude tops $110 a barrel, while Asian stocks fall over fears of the impact of sanctions on Moscow. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half-hour, Russia's military operation in Ukraine is now in its seventh day, with major cities, including the capital Kiev, being the target of attacks. Clashes have erupted in the northeastern city of Kharkiv, where Russian airborne troops have landed. The city's authorities say over the past 24 hours, nearly two dozen people were killed and over 100 others wounded in shelling attacks in the capital Kiev. An airstrike on the main television tower has killed five people and knocked out some state broadcasting. Satellite images show Russian tanks and armored vehicles moving toward the city, with a convoy stretching more than 65 kilometers. Meanwhile, the Russian army has set up checkpoints at entry points in the Black Sea city of Kherson. It's also in control of the city's railway station and port. Russia's defense minister has pledged to push ahead with the operation until its objectives are achieved. Hours ago, U.S. President Joe Biden delivered his first State of the Union address to Congress. The conflict between Russia and Ukraine was the primary theme of his speech, during which he pledged that the West will be all united in the face of the Russian attack on Ukraine.
He thought he could divide us at home, in this chamber, in this nation. He thought he could divide us in Europe as well. But Putin was wrong. We are ready. We are united, and that's what we did. We stayed united.
Biden had some tough words for President Vladimir Putin, accusing him of launching a premeditated and unprovoked war on Ukraine. He called Putin a dictator and said he'll pay a continuing high price over the long run. Biden said Washington, with the help of its allies, is inflicting economic pain on Russia, and he even announced a ban on Russian flights.
We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains. And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy.
Biden also said, and these are his own words, that Washington is choking off Russia's access to technology that will sap its economic strength and weaken its military for years to come. The U.S. president blamed his Russian counterpart for the anti-Moscow sanctions and claimed that Putin has never been so isolated. Biden said the conflict with Ukraine will leave Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger. Earlier, political commentator E. Michael Jones joined us with his take on Biden's first State of the Union address to Congress, which was primarily about the ongoing Ukraine-Russia conflict.
The word that stuck out to me during this address was the word inch, okay? The measurement, the inch. And he said that the United States was going to defend every inch of NATO territory. Now, it's an interesting use of the word, because this whole story started back with the fall of communism using the same word, inch. James Baker, then Secretary of State, assured Mikhail Gorbachev that if they were peaceful about it, collapse of the Soviet Union and the return to Russia, NATO would not move one inch eastward. Now, that's the story. That's the story that's been left out of this this shameful example of chest thumping and back patting each other on the back. The United States simply lied to the Russians about what their intentions were. During the time when Russia was weak and could not respond, the United States moved ever inexorably eastward, one country at a time, year after year after year, edging toward the Soviet, toward the former Soviet Union, toward toward Russia, taking these countries under their control.
Turkey has implemented an international pact on naval passage to the Black Sea. Under the 1936 Montreux Convention, Turkey has the right to close two of its straits to warships. This a week after Ukraine asked Ankara to activate the international pact and prevent the transit of Russian warships from the Mediterranean to the Black Sea. Rashan Sunglin reports from Istanbul.
Turkey has closed the passage of warships through its straits of Bosphorus and Dardanelles. The decision was taken after Ankara called Russia's military action in Ukraine a war. President Erdogan said Turkey is using the authority given to it by the 1963 Montreux Convention Pact on passage of its straits to prevent the escalation of the Russia and Ukraine conflict.
Turkey is determined to use the authority given by the Montreux Convention on Turkish Straits in a manner to prevent escalation of the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
Erdogan said he was very saddened by Moscow's attack on its neighbor, describing the move as unacceptable, adding that Turkey will not abandon its ties with both Ukraine and Russia. The Turkish defense minister, in his turn, asked all sides to respect the international pact Turkey has worked by, assuring that it is Ankara's right to limit passage in the straits in wartime. Kiev had already asked Turkey to close its straits to the Russian warships. The move will prevent more Russian ships from reaching the Black Sea, from where it had launched attacks on Ukrainian southern coast. Analysts say Turkey's decision does not only help Ukraine but also Russia, as the decision prevents all warships, not only Russian ones, from crossing the straits.
Turkey is following a balanced policy between the two countries. The president already clearly stated that Ankara will not take side and stand with neither Russia nor Ukraine. However, enforcing the Montreux Convention is an international procedure, which will not affect Russia negatively, and Ukraine had already asked for it, hence Turkey will not be put in a position to choose sides. However, Turkey already rejects the Russian military action.
Turkey maintains good ties with both Russia and Ukraine, as it bought S-400 missiles from the first and sold the drones to the second, and does not seem willing to risk taking sides in this conflict. It seems that Turkey is trying to remain impartial in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, while it's trying to mediate to end the fight, with President Erdogan making some calls and pushing for a political solution. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Russia's military operation in Ukraine is rattling global markets, with oil prices surging to seven-year highs amid supply disruption fears over the economic sanctions on Moscow. Brent crude oil has surged past $110 per barrel. Also, U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude is up by 5% at about $108. OPEC and other major producers, including Russia, will hold a meeting to discuss increasing output to control price rises. On Tuesday, the International Energy Agency, which includes the U.S., agreed to release 60 million barrels of crude reserves to try and curb soaring prices. But a disruption from Russia, one of the world's top oil suppliers, could send prices even higher. Also, Asian stocks declined as investors fretted about the impact of sanctions on Russia. Observers are concerned that the disruption caused by these sanctions could have a deep negative impact on global growth and inflation. The first Ukrainian refugees have started arriving in Italy after Russia launched a military operation in Ukraine last week. Meanwhile, African refugees have been pushed back when trying to cross the border with Poland.
The first refugees fleeing from conflict-stricken Ukraine have arrived in northern Italy as Europe braces, the media are saying, for a major humanitarian crisis. So far, arriving refugees, who mostly comprise women, children and the elderly, have been registered in four Italian regions, namely Trentino, Veneto, Emilia-Romagna and Friuli-Venezia Giulia. In addition, scores of African-born expats have joined hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to escape Ukraine and cross into Poland and other neighboring countries. Reports have emerged suggesting that many black refugees have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
Africans are being stopped from leaving Ukraine because of the color of their skin. It is shocking. It brings us back to the dark age of racism and intolerance against black people. I'm disgusted, also because the media here in Italy do not cover these stories as they should.
Nigeria and South Africa have denounced such discrimination, calling on border officials in Ukraine and its neighbors to treat their nationals equally. About 30,000 Africans, mostly from Nigeria, Morocco and Egypt, reside in Ukraine. They make up more than 20% of Ukraine's international students, attracted by the country's good technical and medical schools, combined with relatively low fees.
It is a basic principle in international refugee law, as well as in all human rights law, the principle of non-discrimination, a basic principle which has to be observed by all the states, also here, certainly by Poland, Ukraine and the other countries around Ukraine.
The Italian government has recently agreed to redistribute Ukrainian refugees across the European Union. Italy will likely receive 13% of the total allocation. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Mario Draghi said, while reporting to the Senate on the Ukraine crisis, that, quote, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a decisive turning point in European history. Max Civili, Rome.
The United Nations has admitted that some non-European refugees hoping to flee the conflict in Ukraine have faced racism at the country's borders, as tens of thousands seek refuge from the hostilities, images showing the mistreatment of Africans and other non-Europeans continue to circulate. Amina Taylor has more from London.
The heartbreaking images circulating of black and ethnic minority men, women and children trapped in Ukraine as the fighting inches ever closer. Struggling to make it out of the country like tens of thousands of others, but being refused safe passage across the borders of neighboring states, pushed back by officials. The UN's High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, shone a spotlight on the crisis whilst highlighting the humanitarian cost of the current violence. But for those hoping to find safety in the chaos, help has been slow in coming. Journalist Ted Kofi, originally from West Africa, is appalled by the plight of those fleeing, many of whom are international students.
It's slightly cheaper to get that kind of education in the Ukraine than it is in Western Europe or the United States of America. So these aren't just hobos who are hustling a living in a foreign country. And even if they were, the issues around racism here just completely undermine any notion of the idea that a person in distress has a right to be treated like a human being.
Europe has always had a complicated relationship with those coming to its shores from a black and ethnic minority background. But the hope is that countries whose citizens have been impacted can now coordinate their efforts and give those residents the help they truly need.
There are signs that help is coming. Border officials are being given clearer instructions and consular assistance is being ramped up for those who need it. But for many, more should have been done and sooner.
The African governments should have had their ducks lined in a row. They should have had contingency plans laid out to get their own out of these places through safe corridors. They didn't. They got caught. They got caught with their pants down. And who's going to pay? Two things. Their public image across the world. And secondly, the welfare of their own citizens abroad.
When the dust settles, some analysts are urging follow-up action so there is never a repeat of these ugly scenes.
Once they're evacuated back home in Africa, African leaders should raise this issue with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, because what is happening is just beyond belief. It's not acceptable.
The hope is that there is a cessation of violence soon, so no more refugees are created, regardless of background and circumstance. Amina Taylor, London.
U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham's latest comments about Iranian nuclear scientists is drawing outrage from Iranian officials. Tehran's permanent representative to the UN has described the remarks as provocative and terror-inciting. Majid Takht-Ravanchi says Graham's comments are an invitation to additional terrorist acts against Iranian scientists. The UN ambassador described the remarks as repulsive, abhorrent and reprehensible. He said such rhetoric only serves as a green light to the Israeli regime to perpetrate more terrorist acts against Iranian nuclear scientists. In an interview in mid-February, Graham said a lot of Iranian scientists have had a lot of accidents, adding the U.S. would expect even more accidents to come. Several Iranian scientists have been assassinated in Israeli terrorist operations in Iran, the last one being Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who lost his life in a targeted killing near Tehran in November 2020. Reports coming out of Vienna indicate that an agreement on the revival of the JCPOA is within reach, provided the West takes decisive measures, but the French are obstructing the process. Experts in Tehran say France appears to be playing an important role in preventing the resolution of outstanding issues between Iran and the IAEA, and has caused the world body to drift away from its legal and technical role in favor of a more politicized approach. They say in case an agreement is not reached in the Vienna talks, as a result of this issue, France should be held accountable for the failure. Press TV has learned that the Iranian negotiating team is adhering to its stance that no agreement will be achieved unless all of its proposed conditions are met. Under a possible agreement, all sanctions that run counter to the JCPOA must be removed. This process will take months for Iran to verify, and before Iran completes the verification process, the U.S. will not be able to rejoin the deal. Also, the agreement shall come with a strong inherent guarantee that will protect it from non-compliance from the other signatories. Talks over the revival of the JCPOA have been in progress since last April between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Retail, Wholesale and Department Store Union, RWDSU, has filed new precedent-setting charges of misconduct against Amazon with the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, which previously ruled that the company violated the labor rights of its employees at the Bessemer warehouse in Alabama last year. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Mike Ludwig, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Union Files Precedent Setting Charges of Misconduct Against Amazon. Here's the story. The Retail, Wholesale and Department Store Union, RWDSU, has filed new precedent-setting charges of misconduct against Amazon with the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, which previously ruled that the company violated the labor rights of its employees at the Bessemer warehouse in Alabama last year. Bessemer workers are currently voting to whether to join a retail union for a second time after the NLRB determined that Amazon illegally interfered with a closely watched election in April 2021. The original union vote was unsuccessful, but organizing at the Bessemer warehouse and Amazon facilities in New York and Canada continued despite pushback from the retail giant. Removing union literature from break rooms, limiting workers' ability to talk with each other, compelling attendance at captive audience meetings to listen to anti-union messages, all of these actions expose Amazon's undisguised efforts to stifle workers' voices and to contempt for their right to join together, said Wilma Lipman, a former chairperson of the NLRB, in a statement provided by RWDSU. Amazon workers involved in organizing said the company took down pro-union flyers that they put up next to anti-union flyers during their unpaid time off, as they are allowed to do under labor laws. Roger Wyatt, a member of the organizing committee for workers, said workers were forced to attend training meetings with anti-union messaging. Being forced to attend the captive audience anti-union trainings was degrading, Wyatt said in a statement released by RWDSU. Amazon treated us like mindless robots, downloading misinformation to us, and the irony is these meetings are the longest I've ever gotten to sit at work. In a statement to Reuters, an Amazon spokeswoman said the company is confident that it has not broken labor laws. The company said, "Our focus remains on working directly with our team to make Amazon a great place to work." Meanwhile, local support for the Bessemer Union is strong. Nearly two-thirds of residents in Jefferson County, Alabama, say they support a union at the Amazon warehouse in Bessemer. A survey of 1,000 county residents released recently found that 62% supported a union at the warehouse, including 78% of black respondents and 79% of black women. About 85% of the Amazon warehouse's employees are black, and black workers are leading the union drive, according to the Institute for Policy Studies, a think tank that commissioned the survey. The survey released recently included broader questions about economic and social justice issues, along with questions about the union drive at the Amazon warehouse, a major employer in the area. The labor movement has traditionally struggled to build popular support and win union elections in the South compared to other regions, but nearly 50% of white respondents said they support a union at the massive Amazon warehouse. Mark Bayard, director of the Black Worker Initiative at the Institute for Policy Studies, said, "Even in the heart of the Right to Work U.S. South, there is amazing potential for an energized and revitalized labor movement to score major victories and improve the lives of Alabama workers." This survey shows that local community members stand with unionization efforts at Amazon facilities in Jefferson County, despite misinformation campaigns. Workers at Bessemer Warehouse can cast ballots in the current union election until late March. If enough workers vote to join the union, the warehouse will be the first Amazon facility to unionize in the country, potentially setting the stage for others to follow. Lipman added, "What's Amazon afraid of?"
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's the sixth day of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Tit for tat measures underway while more Ukrainians are fleeing their country. Ukraine's president says defending the capital Kiev is its top priority, while Russia has promised to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. Reacting to developments in Ukraine, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the conflict there is the result of U.S. and Western policies. He cited Ukrainian and former Afghan presidents complaining of Washington leaving them high and dry. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this edition of the Spotlight. We'll have research fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamuela, joining us out of Budapest. Also with us will be independent international affairs analyst, Gilbert Doctorow from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me ask George this question. George, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted a few days ago that his country was left alone by the U.S. and the EU. Why did they betray Zelensky after Russia attacked Ukraine?
Well, just before I attempt to answer that question, I want to congratulate Gilbert. He was on few weeks ago with me, and he predicted that this would happen, and most analysts didn't. He did. Well, to answer your question, though, I think that Zelensky was allowed himself to be used by the United States as a battering ram against Russia. I think, unfortunately, that Ukraine was ill-served by the United States and its allies, and this was the inevitable outcome. There was any number of opportunities as the crisis became more intense, particularly when President Putin started speaking about the Russia's red lines. And it should have been clear to the leaders of the West, Macron, Biden, Blinken, and the Germans, that the Russians were serious. And all Zelensky really had to do was at least to make a show of going ahead and talking. They badly let him down. They didn't explain to him that Russia is very serious. Instead, they allowed Ukraine to posture and to make declarations, open declarations, that we're not even going to legitimize the leaders of the Donetsk and Lugansk republics, even though the Minsk agreement explicitly states that the implementation of it requires negotiations between Kiev and the representatives of the Donetsk and Lugansk. They didn't tell him this. They allowed him to shoot his mouth off in Munich about Ukraine becoming a nuclear power. And, as I say, they let him down very badly, and they let Ukraine down very badly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Gilbert, there are people who argue that Ukraine has fallen victim to the West policy, especially those of the U.S., and they argue that the crisis in Ukraine and the ensuing Russian war was instigated by Washington and its post-Cold War expansion of NATO toward Russian borders. What's your take? How do you see the West's role in the war in Ukraine?
Well, the United States, the foreign policy community in Washington, must be delighted that they have lured the Russian forces into a war with Ukraine, which Russia did not want. Mm-hmm. Back in December, Russia highlighted to Washington and to NATO its main concern, which was to sit down at a table and talk about changing the architecture of security in Europe, which for the last 25 years the Russians have found very unsatisfactory, discriminatory, and resulting in ever-increasing threats to their national security through the expansion of NATO to the east. So the NATO question was by itself the number one priority of Russia, and Ukraine was to a certain extent an exhibit A about what NATO was about, why NATO was a threat. Exhibit A has become the whole exhibit at the present, because the issue of Russian security has fallen by the wayside, which delights certainly the power elite in Washington. And yet that is not the case in the final analysis. In the final analysis, what is proceeding day by day in the Russian operations in Ukraine is an attempt to smash NATO to pieces. Because the credibility of NATO, the credibility of the United States, and its security umbrella to all of its charges in NATO is being put to the test. And so far, as your question indicated, the test is being failed by the United States. There was stated before the action began, and as a kind of bait to Russia to act, President Biden said that the United States would never send a soldier to fight to help Ukraine in any war with Russia. This was backed up by other NATO members, and it was perfectly clear that Ukraine was being set up for a disaster. But the United States had no interest in the welfare of Ukraine. That Ukraine is simply a tool that was being used to bait, and if they succeeded, to do great damage to Russian sovereignty and Russian national power.
I'm going to ask you a question about that too. Okay. Now let me ask George about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's spokesman saying Monday that Western sanctions in retaliation for the invasion of Ukraine are designed to topple Russian President Vladimir Putin. Is the U.S. seeking regime change in Russia?
Yes, I think that's been a fairly explicit policy on the part of the U.S. They've been dreaming of a return to the Gorbachev-Yeltsin era, and they've been frustrated year after year by Putin. I mean, we know this from the Hillary Clinton time, you know, that was in 2011, that they were clearly organizing protests in Russia, that they want Putin out. The problem, I think, is, and I think this is a serious one, which is that there's a increasingly a mood in the West for some kind of a confrontation with Russia. There doesn't seem to be any of the restraint that used to animate Western governments. I mean, when you know Eisenhower in 1956 over Hungary, Lyndon Johnson in 68 over Czechoslovakia, and then subsequently, which is there are certain red lines that you don't cross. And you don't even want to start going on that you're going to get into an armed conflict, because that's just going to escalate into a very dangerous area. And unfortunately, too many Western leaders, such as Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and others, are talking openly about getting into some kind of a shooting war with Russia. This is so reckless, so absolutely disastrous, because I think the mood in Russia right now is that war, among the policymakers, that war with the West is inevitable. It may come now, it may come in 2-3 years, but it is coming. And I think that's a...
Gilbert, we also have a group of analysts who believe that the long-term goal of the crisis in Ukraine is to weaken Russia, you know, as part of Washington's willingness and crave for a unipolar world. Do you agree with them?
Well, yes, to contain Russia and to keep it down, that is clearly the objective. At the same time, coming back to the sanctions that have been imposed, which really match what was called previously the nuclear option, that is, devastating sanctions in the economic sphere. I think that the problem is that in Washington and in Brussels, they really don't understand Russia. They have with Russia as it is, analytic skills, the intellectual skills, to deal with. The economic sanctions are very severe. I think Russia expects them to be, because this conflict will end soon. The threats to Russian security and the regime or the government in place is not in that area. The issue for Russia is the Western press has misunderstood totally and so forth. The Russian concern, the nature of the war as a fratricidal war, as a kind of civil war between two peoples that have a common history and very close relations and great number of intermarriages, whereas I'm speaking about the Russian and the Ukrainian peoples. Mm-hmm. And for Russia, they have to proceed. The Kremlin has to proceed very carefully in its military operation, not to present mass slaughter in the American way of war, but to do surgical strikes, to destroy military objects, and to destroy those most radical and elements of the fighting forces in Ukraine, namely these battalions like the Azov battalion that is now surrounded in the Mariupol region, and destroy them separately without taking on the ordinary soldiers, all of whom have mothers and girlfriends and perhaps even relatives in Russia, or not to mention without doing significant damage to civilian infrastructure and to civilian people. So the Russian operation is working under constraints that have nothing to do with what Mr. Macron said, thought he was imposing on Vladimir Putin when they had their telephone call 2 days ago. Mm. Russia is proceeding with supreme caution, and the operation is taking longer and is more difficult than the American way of war, which is to march through with shock and awe and kill everything on your path.
And they call it peripheral damage.
Collateral damage of hundreds of thousands of civilians.
Right.
Yes.
Now, George, Russia's war on Ukraine, many believe, has revealed glaring hypocrisies and racism that Western media and governments are fueling. Let me cite you an example that caused great anger, at least here in West Asia. Maybe you've seen that CBS News senior correspondent, Charlie Diagata. He was reporting from Ukrainian capital Kiev on Friday. He said, I'm quoting him, "This isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan. It has seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European country," end of quote. So what is said is dehumanization of people of color and race and normalization of white supremacy, plain and simple, is it not?
Well, I think there is something of that, but you know, you could also say that the dehumanization of Russians and before that the dehumanization of Serbs was nonetheless played an important role in Western thinking. There is clearly a feeling that the Slavs, such as Russians and such as Serbs, are you don't want to use the old German expression Untermenschen, but you know that's more or less what they think. So that's why when you think of what Russia is doing today is basically much, much less destructive than what the United States did in Iraq, what the United States did in Afghanistan, what NATO did in Yugoslavia. I mean, we've had 5-6 days, and although the media are trying to whip up hysteria about the horrific civilian casualties, they don't have much to work with. And basically, there hasn't been anything of the scale of those U.S.-led operations that I refer to. So why is everyone so indignant? Well, because it's the Russians. Russians don't have the same rights and prerogatives as we Westerners do. When we do it, that's fine. But when they do it, it isn't. And that's in the same thing goes by with all this a lot of heated talk about violations of international law. Well, the United States has been violating international law left, right, and center. Yet never once has anyone tried to impose sanctions on the United States. Never once has the United States been banned from sporting competitions. Mm. Never once has United States oligarchs or very rich people been subjected to sanctions. So there's a very much a different set of standards that apply to the Westerners and to Russians.
Right. Now, on that note, let me ask Gilbert this question. Gilbert, the U.S. and its allies wage unprovoked wars and invasions in several countries: Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Palestine, and Yemen, and this without any U.N. authorization. It killed many people. So are we witnessing a good war, bad war dichotomy here? I mean, how do you explain this hypocrisy?
Well, hypocrisy is the small change of diplomacy everywhere in the world. It has been and it will be. So I wouldn't be in a state of shock over the double standards. That's to be expected. And I don't think that in the Kremlin they are suffering too much from any of the sanctions. You'll notice that the Russians have not responded to these sanctions, other than the banning of airspace, right, where they responded at once, but to the nuclear options, attacks on the central bank of Russia and so forth. They have so far done nothing. And that tells you that they don't believe that these sanctions will long endure and that they have in reserve compensatory sanctions that they are ready to impose if necessary. But there are no rush to do that. Now, what am I talking about? We all know that the BP has said it's going to divest its shares in Rosneft, which are about 20% of Rosneft and are worth at least $25 billion. They will take a beating on that, take a terrible loss, because it's hard to think who exactly, other than the Chinese, are going to stand up and present them with a check to buy their shares. That is the least of it. In the Russians, if they want to respond in like, can confiscate all of European property in Russia, which far exceeds in value whatever is being frozen in Russian assets in the West. But the Russians haven't been in haste to use those countermeasures, because they don't believe that this hysteria that we see today will last beyond a couple of weeks, during which time the problems will be resolved, including the whole question of Europe giving a fast-track admittance to Ukraine. Fast-track normally would mean 18 months. Ukraine, as it presently looks, will be lucky to stay in one piece beyond 2 or 3 weeks, after which it will probably be divided, reluctantly divided, by Russia, in collaboration with local people who are willing to work in and lead the new states.
Yeah. George, did you hear Gilbert's prediction? We'll wait for another 2-3 weeks and see if that comes true, too. Okay, that was my last question, of course, but you just mentioned it now. Now, George, Let's talk a little bit about the way European countries have been welcoming Ukrainians and who are fleeing the war in their country with open arms, which is, of course, a good thing. But they did not treat refugees from Middle East and Africa in, let's say, 2021. They were fleeing wars in their countries, and those wars were caused by the U.S. and NATO. They were responsible for that. Can you shed some light on this?
Well, I think it goes back to your earlier point about hypocrisy. And if you remember, a couple of months ago, we had another bout of hysteria about this was involved Poland and Belarus. And the Poles were absolutely beside themselves over the prospect of 3,000 refugees or migrants or whatever you will coming across the border from Belarus. And the EU was indignant about it, and NATO, and everybody condemned Belarus, and of course by implication Russia, that these people were on the border. And in fact, Poland unleashed a cold water hose. This was late November, so that's pretty nasty. And again, you know, everyone just blamed Belarus and Russia. So yes, there's very much double standards, and exactly, it's, you know, even applies to Viktor Orban, you know, who's been the great champion in Europe of saying no to migrants. He apparently is, you know, welcoming migrants from Ukraine, and so. That, you know, that might cause him some political problems. But yeah, I mean, I think that the Europeans are doing an awful lot of posturing, you know, this obviously with the migrants, but with a lot of very heated bluster in regard to what they're going to do with the Russians. We're going to take on Putin in Ukraine. Well, the Europeans haven't heard a shot fired in anger, you know, for decades, for 75 years. So therefore, the only power capable of fighting Russia is the United States. So it's basically, if they're not going to do any fighting, it's going to have to be the United States. And so far, the U.S. is you know, trying to tamp down this war fever, saying, no, we're not going to be setting up no-fly zones. No, we're not going to get directly involved. So I think the Europeans are behaving in absolutely ridiculous fashion.
Okay, now, Gilbert, we have only 30 seconds if you want to add to your comments, especially your prediction.
Well, it's very difficult to be wise. The situation on the ground changes. I believe that Mr. Putin and his immediate advisors are extremely flexible and have been revising and will continue to revise both strategy and tactics depending on what they see on the ground. And so for us on the sidelines as commentators, it is extremely difficult to predict with any degree of reliability what will happen 2 or 3 weeks from now. But there are just some indications, as I said, that a likely split up of the Ukraine, supervised by the Russians, is in the cards. Whether that happens will depend on the rulers in Kiev presently and how they react to the Russian advances.
Okay, and that note, we come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamueli in Budapest, and Independent International Affairs Analyst, Gilbert Doctor in Brussels. I've been your host, Petr Uznajev, and I'll see you next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero
or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام ما أنقض النوم لعزائم اليوم.
Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "What a breaker is sleep for resolutions of the day."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, from the universal persona of Imam Ali, we continue to learn so many different things. It is quite beautiful and it is quite amazing that even after the passing of over 1,000 and so years, the words of Imam Ali are very much applicable to today and are very much applicable to the present time. Now, one of these beautiful moral, ethical, and lifestyle stances or lifestyles that Imam Ali alayhi salam has taught us is this idea that the people should be at ease from us. Now, the tradition itself goes as such. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "A believer makes himself suffer, but the people are at ease with them." So just to explain this a little bit, a believer makes himself suffer, meaning, I think if we put it into practical terms, it might make more sense. So, for example, there is a hardship that you take upon yourself, but on the other hand, you let the people be at ease. So, let's say, for example, you're going on a trip, and on this trip, there are a few families with you who are also going on the same trip. Now, instead of handing over your own luggage for them to carry, you go out of your way and you carry some of their luggage. Now, what is happening here is that you are making yourself suffer, for lack of a better word. You're putting yourself in hardship, but you're doing this in order to put other people at ease. And so if every single one of us did this, wouldn't we live in a more perfect life? So, for example, if every single one of us took up a little more hardship, a little more difficulty, but it made the lives of other people easier, we really would live in a much better, more perfect world. And so, as Imam Ali alayhi salam says, a mu'min, a believer, makes themselves suffer and makes themselves go through hardship, but the people are at ease with them. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. كل صبح وكل شراب أيام تبكى عيني بدمع مشتاق أيام قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafi. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, take care to provide well for your future abode. Do not barter away eternal blessing for pleasures of this mortal and fleeting world. Do not talk about things which you do not know. do not speculate about and pass verdicts on subjects about which you are not in